testified in the Marion County Circuit Judge Terry Lehman.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for calling this case, or this bill, rather, first. I have a full docket this morning. Senate Bill 45, I really don't have a lot to add to my testimony. I convened a committee with a judge from Central Oregon that does post-conviction, attorney that handles most post-convictions for our, most of them occur in our county because these are inmates that are being held for long periods of time that file these proceedings, and the AG's office. And there were a couple of little problems with the post-conviction statute, which we thought if we made a few changes could, I'd like to say I'm from the government, I'm here to help you, save a little bit of money. Inmates are moved within the institutions, at the institutions for their need. When they move, some of the inmates were trying to change where their post-conviction was being filed, so they asked for a change of venue. Well, the post-conviction proceeding was already happening in the other county. An attorney had been appointed, had already started working on the case. We didn't want the inmates to have the right to do that. Rather, the courts are going to decide on a case-by-case basis when somebody moves if it's cost-effective or more efficient to send it to the other county where the inmate's now being housed. Along with that, we wanted to make it clear in the statute that the inmate can always appear telephonically or through video appearances so that we can save money in transporting them. Because to transport an inmate, you have, for instance, from Central Oregon to Salem, we have to move the inmate on a Wednesday. He sits in our county jail and takes up jail space for, until the hearing is held. It's at least a week. We only transport him on Wednesday, so we're saving some county jail space by allowing him to appear by phone or video if we have video capabilities. Now, I know in Central Oregon, Pendleton, LeGrand, that area, they were having all their appearances by video anyway. So this change in the statute conforms to the practice they already have. So unless there's some questions.
Members, questions? Does anybody understand the bill?
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Hang on a second. Work session, Senate Bill 45.
Chairman.
Senator Murray.
I move that we approve Senate Bill 45 and pass it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 45 be adopted and sent before the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So Senator Walker is excused. He's on the way. And motion passes. And
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 45 be placed on the consent calendar.
All right. Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 45 be placed on the consent calendar for the Senate. Is there any discussion regarding the motion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And apparently we have to have a carrier for that in the event that it's removed from the consent calendar. So I'll be assigned to those bills that are generally assigned to the consent calendar. Somebody else feels a strong desire to carry the bill. Okie dokie. Sorry?
We trust you.
Yeah, about as far as you can throw me. All right. We'll do a public hearing on Senate Bill 19. Okay. All right. It's okay. All right. Well, let me see. Carl Myers, I guess, and Larry Oglesby, and for the committee, apparently Senate Bill 53 is a very similar bill.
Yes.
Everybody signed up. So you might just keep that, even though we're not in a public hearing on 53 officially, just keep that in mind. Carl?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee council. For the record, I'm Carl Myers, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. I'm going to turn the discussion of actually the two bills that are that address a singular problem in the juvenile justice arena, but I wanted to introduce myself for to the committee so that they would know who would be the point person in the building on these two bills. Just as a matter of background, this issue came up last session in the House to address some problems that some of the county juvenile departments were having with housing of people who may be or are subject to the juvenile court. And we were unable to get a bill through last session because of some concerns with the language that we had drafted late in the session. We worked on this bill through the interim, and there are two versions of the same bill. Again, Senate Bill 19, Senate Bill 53 for your consideration this morning. With that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Larry Oglesby, who is the chair of the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Larry Oglesby, I'm the director of the Marion County Juvenile Department. And with me are Rich Scott from Multnomah County Juvenile Department and Timothy Lowen from Yamhill County Juvenile Department to help talk about this issue. The testimony you have in front of you basically outlines the issue as Mr. Myers has addressed it. We have worked on this since the court decision, and as you see, there are two bills in front of you. And what we're here to tell you today is that basically there are pieces of both of those bills which we think could be combined to make a bill that will work to resolve this issue. As we mentioned in our testimony, we think that the approach for addressing this issue ought to be based on three principles: simplicity, flexibility, and minimal impact of the court process. We believe that the juvenile court judges should have the ability to identify in each situation what is the most appropriate placement for a youth who has turned 18 who is under the juvenile court jurisdiction, whether that be in juvenile detention or whether that be in adult jail. In both of the bills, you will find that there are some findings that are required. I know that is one of the issues that some of the folks who have worked on this have in terms of what that impact has on the court process. And we believe that some findings are important to identify the rationale for the court's decision, but that extensive findings may in fact not be necessary. We'd like to give you just three examples of where this comes into play. The first is an example is a youth who commits the offense prior to their 18th birthday, but they're not arrested or charged until after they're 18, still under juvenile court jurisdiction, but are now an adult by virtue of age being 18. The second is a youth who is charged with an offense while they're 17 and then turns 18 while the proceedings are ongoing and the court determines if youth needs to be incarcerated. And then the third, which happens probably more often than the first two, is a youth who is on probation and may have been on probation for some time in the juvenile court, turns 18 and then violates the conditions of the probation. The question is, where can the court place that youth as a sanction? Should it be juvenile detention or should it be court? Prior to the Court of Appeals case, many and perhaps most counties placed those youth in jail. That's no longer possible to do that. We have determined in discussions with the Criminal Justice Commission staff that there are no federal sight and sound issues with regard to this this question of detention or adult jail, regardless of which option the court would choose. And then finally, what we're trying to do here is provide the statutory basis for placement in jail, which did not reside or does not currently reside in statute, which is what the Court of Appeals had found. In terms of how big of a problem this is, the other speakers will also address frequency. I did talk with the juvenile director in Washington County, and when the court case which came out of Washington County came up, they did some research, and their county it happens about six times a year. So it's not that frequent, but when it does happen, it's an issue that needs to be addressed. In terms of how counties are addressing this issue, there's a variety of ways. Some are simply not placing the 18-year-olds. In some, there will be a process where the district attorney files contempt charges for violation of probation, and then you go through the hearing process, right to counsel, et cetera, for the court to place the youth in jail. So it's a it's sort of a gray area and a hole in the system we need to be filled. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Rich Scott.
Chair Minnis, my name is Richard Scott. I'm with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm Assistant Director responsible for juvenile. The particular issues that we have in Multnomah County revolve around both our facility and then trying to decide how we're going to deal with the youth that have been described in the examples that Mr. Oglesby gave. First of all, our facility is designed and staffed to address youth offenders, those people under 18 years of age, to provide programming and safe and secure holding place until they can't appear for court hearings or as a sanction based on a probation violation. Some of the things we've been faced with is trying to, currently we're doing a little bit of both. We're trying to address the issue individually as the youth come to us or those people that have turned 18 come to us. We hold some in our detention facility. We hold some in the adult jail. The ones that we hold in our detention facility present a particular problem because we have been trying to deal with the sight and sound as we saw it, or as we have been given directions to do that, and trying to keep those youth separate in a detention facility that's not designed for both adults and juvenile presents a very big problem. And that's not only true for for Multnomah County, that's true for the other detention centers around the state, I believe. The other problem that Multnomah County faces particularly is that youth who are placed on probation until their 25th birthday are under the juvenile jurisdiction, our juvenile court's jurisdiction. We have some sex offenders that are placed on probation until their 25th birthday. Those youth we haven't had to deal with yet, but if they have a probation violation or something and come back to us, we're going to be faced with the issue of what to do with a 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24-year-old. We are very reluctant to hold those in our detention center, obviously, but we don't have an answer at this point. I think these two bills or some compromise of these two bills would hopefully help us address that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Chair and Minister, my name is Tim Lowen. I'm director of the Yamhill County Juvenile Department. I want to state that our system has been, I think, a real positive one for a lot of the youth that come into our system. They are dealt with through the juvenile justice proceedings through placed on probation through age 23 and can be committed to the youth authority through age 25. If they are 18 years old and commit a crime, they're considered an adult in our system. And so oftentimes you'll see young men, young women in the jail facilities that are 18 years or older. The dilemma that Mr. Scott brings up, it does carry across numerous detention facilities in our state, whereby we have youth that are placed on probation and may be on probation in treatment in the community, may violate their probation, but at 23 years of age, because there's no other means for them, may be placed with younger kids, younger juvenile offenders, in a detention facility. Juvenile detention facilities can take youth 12 years and up, and through court consideration, even younger than that. So the problem oftentimes comes up is we have numerous youth offenders on juvenile jurisdiction varying in age from as young as 12 or even younger in some cases to as old as 23 in the same facility. That presents some security and safety issues at the same time. What we would like is through these bills and amendments to them is that the court would have some jurisdiction to determine what's in the best interest of the youth and their placement, their youth offender, whether that be into the juvenile detention facility or into a jail facility.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add a couple of issues. One, in the example number three, I need to give an example of why this is important to be able to do this. It's not uncommon for youth to be on probation for a period of time and have completed all their conditions of probation except for paying restitution to their victim. We take that issue very seriously in terms of making sure victims are compensed by the youth who commits these crimes. And one of the tools that the court has is to bring that youth back before the court once they've turned 18 and say you haven't paid your restitution and give them, as an example, 10 days in jail suspended. And it's amazing how quickly some of these youth find the money to pay their restitution. So it's a tool that's used by the juvenile court and one that we think really furthers the interests of public safety and the issues of victims in our community. The other thing I wanted to mention is I did mention sight and sound issues, and I thought I should be a little more specific about that. In the juvenile code and as well as in federal rules and regulations, there's a prohibition of incarcerating juvenile offenders within sight and sound of adult offenders. And typically that, historically, that has been an issue where you had adult jails where previously youth under the age of 18 were housed in the same facility. And so that is prohibited by statute and by federal law for the juveniles under the age of 18. What we're dealing with here is youth who are over 18 who at the same time are under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court but are of the age of majority for other purposes and if arrested again would in fact be incarcerated in jail on the adult offense. So that's the gray area here we have in the sight and sound balance that tries to be struck here.
All right. Senator Ferriola.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm hearing the term sight and sound, and I guess I'm wondering whether the sight and sound isn't a euphemism for a close contact. under these circumstances where you're prohibited from keeping youth and adult offenders from encountering each other personally or even sight and sound, that indicates to me that you keep those youth offenders segregated from the adult population. The bills that you're proposing that we have before us, would that eliminate the requirement to segregate youth populations from adult populations? In other words, would you be incarcerating youth in close contact with adult offenders?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, it would remove that requirement only for those who have reached the age of 18. For all other youth offenders under the age of 18, the prohibition for sight and sound separation would, in fact, be still in place.
So, Mr. Chairman, what I hear them saying is that on your 18th birthday, you're dropping to the general population.
I think that's right, because you're... Well, actually, if I'm reading the bills, now we'll get to this, because I'm going to open a public hearing on 53. And the way I seem to understand the bill so far in my capacity is that the Senate Bill 53 grants permission to put the person in jail subject to the court's approval, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
That's pretty much it. Okay, the judge will... There's a process. The judge has to make that determination. 53 does the same but sets parameters with respect to how that would happen, correct?
Mr. Chairman, the bills basically attempt to do the same thing. There's two primary differences. One bill deals only with post-adjudication. The other deals with both pre- and post-adjudication, both of which issues need to be addressed. Senate Bill 19 does address both of those issues, both pre-adjudication and post-adjudication. There are some other differences in terms of findings and some of those issues. In answer to Senator Farioli's question, they move from a juvenile facility to an adult facility, so it's not like moving across the lines into a general population. They go to a completely different type of facility at the age of 18.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm confused. That's under current practice?
No, that's what these bills would accomplish, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli.
So the point is, at age 18, one of your little observances of your birthday is that you're going to be transferred to an adult facility and dropped in general population.
That's correct.
I thought we should know what we're talking about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Burdick.
But to clarify, this would not affect juveniles who are incarcerated in an OYA facility who might be there until the age of 25. And this only affects probationers and pre-adjudication, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's correct. This is at the local level. This does not impact at all the Oregon Youth Authority individuals.
Okay, so to follow up, you're really talking about situations where, you know, you're not talking about a massive shift of juveniles 18 and over into adult facilities. You're only talking about juveniles who are on probation or before they are convicted, and you're only talking about that population.
Ms. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments or questions by committee members? Council.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I wanted to bring to your attention, I did put in a copy of the appellate case that was mentioned. I think Mr. Oglesby mentioned it. It's State versus Thompson, 176 or App 27. And Mr. Oglesby, I also wanted to ask you, too, to make sure we understand the sight and sound issues in a juvenile detention facility when there is a youth offender who's over the age of 18, how is that handled, say, in the Donald E. Long? I guess I should ask Mr. Scott, how is that handled at Donald E. Long, for example, just for the record?
Yes, Mr. Prinz. Currently what we're doing, we're housing in Multnomah County, we house Measure 11 youth in our detention facility. And we are housing our 18-year-olds, or co-locating them with those Measure 11 youth who are under the age of 18. Now, that presents problems still of separation from other youth and things, and that I think there is, it's a difficult situation for us, but that's how we're dealing with it at this point until it's resolved by this bill, hopefully.
Okay. Thank you. I think we've got a couple other people that would like to testify. Senator Farioli.
I guess just the troubling issue for me is the idea of matriculation, that youth offenders have an experiential base and the decision to incarcerate them and segregate them from more experienced and older inmates was made for a particular reason. And I haven't heard anybody argue that that reason no longer is valid. So, how do you, you know, recidivism is a big issue. You're trying to steer these people out of a criminal career, but you're at age 18, you're essentially allowing them to hone their skills in criminal enterprise by putting them in with hardened and much more experienced inmates. Can you argue to the contrary?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perreault, typically the youth we're talking about are youth who have been through the juvenile system, who have had a variety of strategies and services provided to them, and which apparently have not been successful to that point. The bigger issue I think that we see is once that person becomes over 18, they may have been a youth who's been to the state training school and back into the community. Their level of sophistication in criminal enterprise is a negative influence on the 12 through 17-year-old who would be in the same facility.
Thank you for an orientation to the career ladder.
But I think that's really the point here. You're trying to say, let's not put experienced people in the population that you're trying to keep at least on a track where they have the possibility of redeeming themselves to some degree. Any other questions?
Just to address maybe Senator Ferriola's concern, if a person were 18 and maybe they were on probation but they committed a fresh crime, there'd be no question they would be processed through the adult correction system. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. And if you're here, you'll stand down. I'll call up there. I think it's Kathy Berger. I have to put my glasses on here.
That's my calendar.
Apparently you've changed your name. You confuse all of us. Used to be. But there you go.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I did change my name. For the record, Kathy Berger from Juvenile Rights Project. I'm a senior delinquency attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I think all of you are familiar with the Juvenile Rights Project, so I'll just go into my testimony about Senate Bill 19. Juvenile Rights Project believes that anybody who's adjudicated in juvenile court or about to be adjudicated in juvenile court should get all the services available to them through the juvenile court system, and that includes the services that are given to youth and youth offenders in juvenile detention facilities. We have specific rules for juvenile detention facilities that include counseling, the amount of exercise that a juvenile is supposed to get, health care, education, and those are there for a purpose because when we adjudicate a juvenile, we also, what is attached to that is a right for the juvenile to receive treatment in order to rehabilitate him or herself. So it's our position that this really doesn't need to be fixed, and there's a way to get around what is perceived to be the problem by the juvenile directors. Mr. Oglesby is correct in that whatever we do in fixing this problem will not violate federal sight and sound regulations. I think that's probably pretty clear. Senator Ferrioli was correct that sight and sound regulations were put into effect. Basically, they're very strict. It's not just they can't be housed together. They can't see one another, and they can't hear one another. The reason for the sight and sound regulations is so that the older adult inmates can't be essentially harassing, cajoling, doing anything to the juveniles. Oregon also has a sight and sound separation statute, which is in the juvenile code, which is 419A. 0.063. The way that this problem came up was not only the appellate decision in Thompson, which said that the juvenile court did not have the jurisdiction to order a youth offender or a youth over the age of 18 into an adult jail, but also because of a Multnomah County Council opinion about how we define adult and children within the parameters of 419A063. Thank you. Getting over a month-long cold. According to the Multnomah County Council, when you look at that, all we have is in the statute, it says that children cannot be housed in the same facility or within sight and sound of adults. Multnomah County Council, adult is not defined in the juvenile code, and Multnomah County Council looks to other statutes within the ORS to define adult as anybody over the age of 18. We do not violate federal regulations, and in fact, the federal government allows us to define adult and juvenile any way the states want to define adult and juvenile for their own sight and sound separation policies. So it is possible for us to fix this problem by defining adult as anybody over 18 who is charged or convicted in criminal court, and then what that does is allow anybody who's over 18 to be held in a juvenile detention facility and receive all the services of the juvenile detention facility without the concern of the juvenile departments that they would be breaking Oregon's sight and sound separation, the sight and sound separation statute. So that's an easy way to fix this. To clear up some things that were talked about, first of all, a juvenile cannot stay on probation until they're 25. They can be on parole until they're 25, but they can only be on probation until their 23rd birthday. If a juvenile has been committed to a youth correctional facility, which they can be committed to a youth correctional facility up until their 19th birthday, if they've been committed to a youth correctional facility and break a parole violation, they can be immediately brought back into and have a parole violation. They can be immediately brought back by the Oregon Youth Authority into a youth correctional facility. So anybody who has been already sent to a youth correctional facility, if there's an allegation after they're 18 that they've committed a parole violation, they can be brought back, stop whatsoever, into the youth correctional facility. Right now, there's a stop in between because they need to have a parole hearing, and so they hold the juveniles into the juvenile detention facility or an adult jail while they're awaiting that parole hearing. However, because they don't want the transportation cost, I think there's other ways that we can solve that problem, but they can be brought immediately back into the correctional facility. If the committee, however, wants to place the youth into adult jails, which is what both Senate Bill 19 and 53 want to do, Juvenile Rights Project believes that Senate Bill 19 is the better bill. In terms of, it requires that a court make specific findings that certain elements that a youth or a youth offender is entitled to is available to that youth or youth offender in the adult jail. In other words, the specific findings are necessary because we have juveniles who are age 19 who are very low functioning and very small and are receiving special education services. Those youth or youth offenders in an adult jail would face serious consequences because they are mixed in with the general population. There's no designation between the youth or youth offenders that are being held in adult jails and the adults that are being held in adult jails. So what 19 requires is that a court look at making specific findings. And this is in the first, and they're mirrored for both the pre-adjudication and post-adjudication youth, but they're found in subsection 2, which starts at line 9 on page 1. And what we want the courts to look at is, first of all, the person's mental health and whether their mental health needs are going to be met in the jail or other place where adults are detained, their educational status and whether their educational needs can be met in the jail or other place where adults are detained, and their physical and emotional maturity and whether the person's safety needs can be met at the jail or other place where the adults are detained, and any other special treatment needs of the person. These are important because these are rights that have attached to this person. We have a large portion of of youth offenders who are special education kids, and those special education rights attach until their 21st birthday. If they're held for a significant period of time in an adult jail, even 8 days, they are entitled to have their special education needs met. And their IEP, their current IEP, needs to be met within the adult jail or the juvenile detention facility, wherever they are held. and it does not seem reasonable to me that if they were held in a juvenile facility and their special education needs could be met there, they should be placed in an adult facility where they receive no educational services whatsoever. The same is true with the mental health needs and the other physical, the other special treatment needs. Oftentimes, these are youth that are receiving counseling. That counseling is somewhat available in juvenile detention facilities. It has to be through statute, and many adult jails would not also provide those treatment. And then we also added in is the person's physical and emotional maturity. And the reason that we think that should be looked at is because you can get the 18-year-old who's low functioning, who's 4'10" and weighs less than 100 pounds soaking wet. We recognize that there's also the 18-year-olds who are 300 pounds, 0% body fat, and 6'5". And it seems to me that it's important for a court to look at the individual juvenile and determine whether that individual juvenile will be safe in an adult jail or the adult jail could keep that individual safe
question. Senate Bill 53 says on line 16 that the court may order. Is it your assertion then that the court would not consider those things as a matter of course?
The court, it's not that I don't think courts would. I think it's important for the legislature to give the judges an outline of what the legislature believes is important for the court to look at. I think that when it's broad-based, the court can just say, well, you're 18, and I think you're going to get a good educational experience by being in an adult jail.
So, Kathy, how is that different in Senate Bill 19, where on line 10, started line 9, it says, in determining whether to order detention of a person under subsection 1 of this section, the court shall consider, those are key words, and make written findings of fact. The words shall consider are not very strong.
They're not very strong. You're correct, Senator Chairmanis. But I think the requirement for written findings of fact will at least allow a defense attorney the opportunity to know why the youth is being put into the adult jail and be able to make specific arguments about why the youth should not or should be put in, would make both sides of the.
So the difference between Senate Bill 53 and 19 would be the court may order, they can simply do that orally, that's part of the court record. There's no written findings of fact. In Senate Bill 19, they can consider these things. They do the written findings of fact. But it could be just as simple as, I've reviewed the case, and in my opinion, this individual is qualified in the following level above.
Chairman, that's correct.
Yeah, I mean,
that's correct.
It can be pretty vague. Just the judge has to write it down.
That's correct.
Or have it written down, and then they sign it. Okay. You want to go ahead and...
I have nothing further unless the committee has any other questions.
Okay. Senator Ringo.
Do you agree that the current structure contains an ambiguity that we need to clear up?
Chairman, as Senator Ringo, I think that there is an ambiguity just because of the acceptance that the Multnomah County Council's opinion has received throughout the state. I don't agree with the Multnomah County Council's opinion. I think that the Multnomah County Council has defined adults far too broadly, and that not what was intended by the legislature, but the legislative intent is actually unclear.
Okay, but I guess you agree that there's a problem we need to address. Now you have an alternate solution that you would agree this committee should do something.
Chairman is Senator Ringo, that's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Kathy, I've got one other person. Timothy Travis is someone you know well. We'll have Timothy come up and assuming he's there. There he is. It's your turn.
Thank you, Senator Minnis. For the record, I'm Timothy Travis. I have not changed my name since the last session. I didn't think it would do me any good. I figured the chair would recognize who I was and remember. I work with the Oregon Judicial Department. And let me say right off the bat, the judges very much want the ability to see all of the people in these three categories that the juvenile directors have pointed out held, if that is the appropriate thing to do. The issue is where, obviously, they should be held. We have had a lot of discussion this morning about sight and sound. And I think that the weight of opinion is that sight and sound is not really an issue here, because sight and sound is not based on how old you are, how big you are, or how much you weigh. It's based on what jurisdiction you're under. If you are 19 years old and weigh 300 pounds, you are a juvenile. If you are 17 years old and you have been waived into the adult system, you're an adult. The important thing to understand in the juvenile system is that the words don't necessarily mean what the dictionary says they mean. The sight and sound is not an issue. One issue that hasn't been brought up here today is that there is an argument that due process might be a problem for lodging those who are under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court in an adult facility. Because if one is under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court pursuant to 419C, which is the delinquency code, that means that one's liberty has been impinged without the full panoply of due process rights. You have not been accorded a jury trial. You have not been accorded the right to bail. Therefore, there is an argument that says you cannot be put in an adult jail because the exchange that you made with the state in return for not having a jury trial and for not having bail is that you are entitled to treatment, not punishment. So there is an argument to be made that you cannot put an 18, 19, 20-year-old person who has not had a jury trial, has not had the right to bail, in jail. Earlier, Senator Burdick asked the question, could this apply to kids in the OIA? There is a case from the great state of Louisiana in which the state of Louisiana had a law that said that kids in an OIA-type setting at the age of 18 would have their situation reviewed, and under appropriate circumstances, they would just be transferred to an adult prison. And the court struck that down on exactly the grounds that I'm talking about today, that those young people had not been accorded their full panoply of due process rights. Now, let me emphasize that I am not here telling you that that's necessarily how it's going to come out, or that I necessarily believe that that's how it's going to come out, or that I think that's how it should come out. It's just that I believe the committee should consider this situation and what the impact of this could be. Judge Barron from Coos Bay, who is one of the judges to whom many look in the juvenile area, explained this in his email to us, this very consideration. But as I say, the judges want the problem solved. They want to be able to hold these people. Now, a few considerations on what's been talked about today. We were very pleased to hear the proponents sort of waffling on the exact criteria to be used and the exact findings to be made. I shouldn't say waffling, but at least softening their position, because the judges do not like the detailed findings in Senate Bill 19. And the reason they don't like the detailed findings is that it says that the judge shall consider and make written findings about each and every one of those considerations. This decision is going to be made sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, when the judge has no idea what the particular individual's situation is vis-a-vis these findings. These findings are appropriate for a full-blown dispositional hearing, but they're not appropriate for a decision to be made on the spot. The other consideration is whether or not, if you look at the findings under Senate Bill 19, which I believe an argument could be made, I believe an argument could be made to say that if a judge can make all those findings about a jail, that perhaps the jail is providing the treatment that would be necessary to complete the trade-off between due process and treatment. But as I look at that list of considerations, I wonder, could any jail in Oregon meet those standards? I just don't know. Because if they could, then I think they'd be juvenile detention facilities and not jails. So we would be very pleased to work with the proponents of this bill around the specific findings to try to get a workable bill through the committee. The judges are very anxious that this problem should be solved. And so that's essentially what I had to say.
Thank you. Question, Senator Burry.
Chairman, can you envision a solution by working things out that would address the due process concern, which I kind of occurred to me until you mentioned that?
Well, can I envision that? I'm not sure that I can. I'm not sure that I can. I don't think I can. I think that if one is found within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, according to this argument, then one is a juvenile. And if one is being held as a juvenile, then one is being held as a juvenile. The juvenile director's bill talks about people who are juveniles who violate their probation in such a way that they could be charged with a crime. The solution there would be to charge them with a crime. And then you're out of all this.
Because then they would get their due process.
That's correct. But there's a possibility that if you have a situation like this, either of these bills, you could end up with someone on juvenile probation who a condition of their probation is that they go to school, and they violate that probation, and they end up in jail for not going to school. Now, I don't know that that would ever happen, but it's a possibility. And let me emphasize, I'm not advocating anything here. I'm just trying to inform the committee of an argument that could be made.
If you're not expressing it, a great deal of faith in our judges by saying that someone might end up in jail because they're in school, but I assume that a judge would take that into consideration.
I hope, Senator Minnis, that my working relationship with judges would assure them that I have a great deal of faith in them.
No, I'm just based on your statements. Let me ask you a question which you may not have an opinion of, but if there is a court hearing in both Senate Bill 15 and Senate Bill 53, correct? There's a court hearing, there's a judgment by the court, which is in and of itself some degree due process, and then there's a limitation on the amount of time in which this juvenile could be placed in an adult facility. At least what I'm reading here correctly, an 8-day limitation. So notwithstanding Kathy's comments about the educational requirements, et cetera, it doesn't seem to me that 8 days is such a large infringement upon that duty or responsibility that it would cause the court to do something otherwise.
Senator Maris, I don't think it's such a large infringement either, and I'm just saying that there is this argument to be made.
Well, that's what lawyers do.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
Certainly is, and certainly will be.
That's
certainly
why I
is.
Like this committee, because I get these lawyers arguing amongst each other.
Sort of like shaking up ants in a jar, isn't it?
Kind of, exactly. Yes, exactly. In perpetuity, you get arguments. Any other questions or political comments or anything else? Okay. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 19? If not, public hearing Senate Bill 53. Anybody have anything else to say about Senate Bill 53? Okay, no additional testimony on Senate Bill 53. Who wants to be the working group that puts this together? Carl, you're like the hub of the wheel here?
Yes, sir. Sure.
All right, who do you want to work with? Anybody you don't want to work with? Yes, sir, we are.
anybody who wants to work can work through the offices of the committee council?
Yes, please do that. And how long do you think it would take to come to some resolution?
I don't know. I'll report after our group.
Okay, I'll give you 2 weeks or the bill's dead.
Okay.
Okay, 2 weeks from today. All right, you get the people together. 2 weeks, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53, Senate Bill 19. Now we're going to move on to Senate Bill, 24. All right. Now I've got to be really on my toes. All right, Senator Burdick, the Honorable Vice Chairperson of the
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Ginny Burdick, State Senator from District 18. And with me today is John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm here to explain and support Senate Bill 24, which actually started out as an idea that I got after the September 11th terrorist attack on our country, when it happened in Oregon and it happened nationwide, but specifically in Oregon, where people, after the anthrax situation arose, people would send talcum powder through the mail, or basically as a joke, or maybe sometimes there's a more serious threat. Sending something like that through the mail is a federal crime, but in that atmosphere of crisis, what happened on the ground was just an unconscionable diversion of law enforcement energy and resources to basic hoax situations. So I ask that this bill be drafted to create a state cause of action for hoaxes of this kind. And in the process of doing that, it turned out that the actual sending of the actual substance through the mail was not a state offense, or there seemed to be a loophole there. So at this point, John Bradley came riding in for for some help on the bill, and he added some other provisions to the bill that is before you, and I will let him describe what those are.
Mr. Bradley.
And I will move back to my seat unless there are questions.
Thank you.
Chair Menas, members of the committee, I'm John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I have a number of things to say about Senate Bill 24, and I think one of the things I'll leave you with is to say that this is not a done product. We need to, there are some inconsistencies in the bill that I think we need to work on, and I would hope we could do that too quickly, and I'll point out what those are. Senator Burdick is correct. Is that until September 11th of last year, these are things that I don't think we really thought, you know, were that serious, or, you know, there are always crimes that are potential, but oftentimes are things that when the law becomes the law, we realize it's a possibility, but we don't see them as probabilities. And I guess the example was in 1971 when we enacted the criminal code. There were computers around, but who ever thought about computer crime? Who thought about identity crime? But then we find with the passage of time that we do have people who, you know, start committing these kinds of crimes, and there's a need for a change. And I think there is a change. There needs to be a change in this area. What this bill does, as Senator Burdick says, is it talks about, I would suggest, you could divide this up into four sections, and I apologize, I don't have written statements for you, and the reason I don't is because I was a little derelict. I waited until last night to really go through and start, you know, dissecting the bill, and also got up early this morning and did it, and by the time I was done, I realized that you are going to need some written testimony and possibly some amendments, and I'll get into those in a second. But what it's basically broken down into three or four sections. One, it just says that anybody who develops, manufactures, delivers, or possesses or uses a harmful substance, toxin, or a delivery system. And when they talk about a delivery system, they're talking about microorganisms and putting things in the air. These are very, very serious offenses, obviously. Things that we wouldn't have thought about until, you know, within the last 18 months. The second thing is the possession of the hoax destructive device. This is probably what Senator Burdick started off with and what she was trying to get to. And it basically says that if somebody, I'll give you an example, somebody sends somebody in the mail a bomb, or looks like a bomb, to scare them. That this would be, you know, when the person gets it, the person would look at it and think, you know, this is a bomb, scared for their life, and that would be a Class A misdemeanor. If the person did it during the course of a felony, it would then be a Class C felony. The next thing, and I guess I would say it's the third and fourth change, is currently, if somebody calls the courthouse and says that there's a bomb in the courthouse, the most that we can figure out is that's a Class B misdemeanor, and it's found under disorderly conduct. And going back to 1971, when this became the law and what the argument was in 1971, in fact, even though I didn't participate in 1971, I was in the district attorney's office in 1971, this became the law. And this was really to get at fire alarms. You know, when somebody went down and pulled the firebox, they wanted to make it a crime. And, you know, last night as I was thinking about coming here in Portland anyway, we don't have fire alarms anymore. I mean, they just don't exist. And again, maybe in 1971 people would sometimes call call someone and say there's a bomb in a building, but I'm just saying that having been in the district attorney's office in 1971, that was extremely rare. And so in 1971, what we had was they wanted to get to something to deal with the, you know, pulling a fire alarm, and they made it disorderly conduct. And that's really what we have if somebody calls the courthouse today and says that there's a bomb in the courthouse. Now, the reason why I think this needs to be reworked, I think the first thing is this, and again, this is not Senator Burdick talking, this is John Bradley talking, because she might, these are things that she hasn't heard, but nonetheless, I think they're things that you as a committee need to consider. First of all, on the unlawful development, manufacturing, delivery, possession of a harmful substance and the delivery thereof, I would suggest instead of a B felony, that this ought to be an A felony, much like racketeering, and be an unclassified felony. And the reason I say that is because you can have, under this law, if you had somebody who had one little piece of paper that had a toxin on it, that would be a crime. On the other hand, if you had somebody who had two truckloads full of toxin, that would also fall in that category. And when I was thinking about it, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the racketeering statute, but under the racketeering statute, you can have actually fairly minor conduct, which qualifies as racketeering, and then you can have very, very serious underworld-type conduct that qualifies as racketeering. And what the legislature did when they passed the racketeering statute was they made it an unclassified A felony. In other words, it would give the judge, the judge would look at the conduct, would look to see if there were other statutes similar, and then would decide where the judge would categorize that crime. Now, these are things in which, as far as this crime goes, hopefully we'd never see one, but you might see one every 2 or 3 or 4 years. I mean, it's something that will happen. It will not happen very often, and hopefully it would not happen on a mass. And I think where you generally find it is you would find it where somebody would agree to sell a bunch of anthrax to somebody and would show up with a truck full load of it. Under our current law, we don't have anything specifically handling that. To have a Class A unclassified felony, it would give law enforcement an arm and a tool that would be effective in that particular situation.
The could go over this for the committee. When you say unclassified felony, an unclassified felony is an A felony unless the judge decides otherwise. Is that right, or am I understanding that correctly?
Chairman, no. What you have is this. You have unclassified felonies, but the law says when you have an unclassified felony, if the law isn't designated, it's generally presumed to be a Class C felony. What I'm saying is a Class A felony is generally ranked by the, you know, the crime seriousness, and it's the, in other words, like, you know, a robbery, maybe a class 9, because that's what we've categorized it as. But if you say that something is unclassified, it's not a category 1, 2, 3, 4, or 10, it's something that's left up to the judge to decide based upon the seriousness of the conduct. Let me give you an example, racketeering. Racketeering, when someone's convicted of racketeering, that's a Class A felony. But it's, you know, sometimes we talk about, and I don't have my sheet here, as saying, you know, is this a level 9, is this a level 10, or is this a, or whatever. When something's unclassified, the judge looks at the underlying conduct to see how serious it is and where it ought to be put on the crime seriousness scale.
So it remains an A felony, but the judge has discretion with respect to where
yes.
to put it.
Yes, and the intent of that was is to make, you know, that there are some crimes that just because you can't, I mean, like a robbery, when somebody walks into the store, generally speaking, those are generally speaking pretty much the same. I mean, they'll vary, but as far as just a robbery with nothing more. But when you're talking about producing and trying to distribute,
right.
These kinds of things, it can range from a very minor thing to a very major thing.
Okay.
And it's real hard to, you know, to set an example.
Okay, but in the construct of this new law, you wouldn't have a lesser included crime, would you? I mean, you'd go from an A felony to...
Well, the only thing you... No, it would not go... It would if a person was found guilty of the substantive charge, it would still remain an A felony.
Right. And which is why, I guess, you know, sometimes a person will plead guilty to a lesser included type of...
Well, a person can plead guilty to an attempt. I mean, there'd be...
Which would be a...
That would be a Class B,
right.
Unranked. The next provision is what I've called possession of a hoax destructive device. And that was Senator Burdick's original idea. And what it just says, I think... excuse me. It says somebody who, if a person places another person in fear of serious physical injury,
that's on page 2, line 8.
I know, I've got it. Then, and I think it's the situation where somebody says there's a, you know, I've planted a bomb at your house. That would make that a Class A misdemeanor. Now, I'm suggesting, and again, I'm not saying Senator Burdick agrees with this because we haven't talked about it, but I'm suggesting that perhaps ought to be a C felony. And the reason I do is, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, this will come under the category of a crime we currently have called menacing. If I place a bomb, or not a real bomb, but something that looks like a bomb behind you, and I call you on the phone and say, you know, Senator Menace, there's a bomb behind you, and you look and you get scared, that's currently probably a menacing, which is a Class A misdemeanor. So I don't know that we've changed things. I think that if you were to say it places another person in fear of physical injury as opposed to serious physical injury, that may be something you want to keep at a Class A misdemeanor. Nonetheless, I realize this is the first time I've you know, you've been... Then we go, and this is what the problem is as far as consistency within the statute. Again, this is my fault because I put it in... I kind of threw this in, and it was another bill. But the menacing in the first degree, as I've said before, what I have done is I've put in this on Section 9, and it says, a person commits the crime of menacing in the first degree if with the intent to cause public inconvenience, annoyance, and alarm, or recklessly creates a risk thereof, the person initiates or circulates a threat of alleged impending fire, explosion, catastrophe, or other emergency likely to cause alarm or concern. This is a Class B felony. Well, let me tell you, this is less conduct than the Senator Burdick's, the what she has in it. So you have two you have a lesser conduct being a B felony, and the actual more serious conduct being an A misdemeanor. Obviously, that's something that the committee needs to change. But what I would, and again, I'm throwing this out for the first time, I think this Section 9 needs to be changed. And the way I think it needs to be changed is perhaps it shouldn't be a B felony, perhaps it ought to be a C felony. And where it says likely to cause alarm or concern, there should be an additional words after that, and fear of death or serious physical injury. And then I think it makes it more consistent with the hoax device. And again, I know I've said a lot, and I'm speaking legalese here, and I'm confusing, and I'm sorry I didn't have this all done before the bill was introduced, because I certainly saw a copy of it. But so often what happens is they sit on your desk, and you don't really think about it a lot until you're called down and have to speak to a committee such as this. And so for that, I apologize for my lack of diligence.
Mr. John, I appreciate your candidness in terms of the bill needing work. So I appreciate that. Senator Ringo.
If I could ask a question about Section 2. This creates a crime for unlawful development, manufacture, delivery, possession, or use. And then it talks about an unlawful purpose, and it doesn't directly link it with harming people, or does it?
Senator Ringo, I think it's almost necessary to use that word, unlawful purpose, because, and I'm not going to answer your question directly, I guess. The reason I think this is necessary is because if you don't include unlawful purpose, you could potentially have people who are in a lab fitting this definition, and you really do need the term unlawful purpose. Now, if it's to poison somebody, that's obviously an unlawful purpose.
And that's already covered. If you're doing something with intent to poison somebody, that's already probably a Class A felony.
If you do it, no. If I put together something to harm somebody, that may be an attempt. Until I actually do it, and therefore it could be a felony, but it's probably not going to be a Class A felony. It'll probably, if my intent is to say poison everybody here and kill them, and I'm starting to make the substance with that purpose, and then I get caught before I complete it, that's an attempt. So that would be an attempted assault one. If I did it just to make you all sick, that might be a Class C felony. So it depends upon what your intent is,
right,
and how far along you got. But I think one of the things that we see as prosecutors is that sometimes, you know, somebody has, say, a truck full of anthrax. How do we prove that their intent was to kill people? And, you know, you'd say, well, what other reason is there? And I would tend to agree, but it's something you want to prohibit, and one of the ways of prohibiting it is to say you just can't even possess it. And unless you have a lawful purpose, you can't have this stuff, just like we say with our drugs.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I guess I'm just thinking that there's a lot of harmful biological and chemical substances that are dealt with every day in industry, and every now and then something illegal probably happens to some of them. There's no hint of bioterrorism or use as a chemical agent. It's just they're harmful substances. Are there scenarios out there like that?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, I'd have to think about the example you're trying to give, because I mean, this is aimed at obviously people who are in the business of taking biological and chemical substances with the idea of doing something, bad toward people.
Right.
To be able to define things exactly is never possible in the criminal law. And I guess one of the things that, you have to rely upon sometimes you have to rely upon the discretion of the district attorney as far as, when you proceed and when you don't proceed. Because there is some, like I say, under the racketeering statute, which is a very powerful statute. If you took two people and they went out and they stole from two different stores on two different days, that's racketeering under the statute. And you know, we don't do it. And
two predicate acts. But is it illegal right now to possess anthrax?
It probably, I don't know what the, if you're asking me under the state law,
I don't know. You know, under what I generally deal with in the, you know, the state statutes, I don't know of a statute, but there, you know, you may have some things under the environmental statutes and things like that come into play, but nothing that I, as a prosecutor, would just come to mind.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I mean, you still, this requires for an unlawful purpose, which means that somehow in the prosecution of such a crime, you've got to have information that the substance would be distributed somehow. It would be disseminated in intending to harm people.
Chair Minnis, Senator Ringo, I don't know if that's correct, because let's go back to anthrax. You know, it's one thing to make, you know, when somebody's dealing with a small thing. Let's talk about the truck full of anthrax. If somebody wants to buy it, you know, you don't, you know, I can't prove what that person was going to buy it for. I can't prove, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt that that person was going to do it to disseminate, you know, to poison people with it. And therefore, as far as a prosecution goes, I don't have a very good prosecution. I mean,
but you still have to prove that, though, under Section 2 of this statute, don't you?
I do. And if somebody possesses such a large quantity, I think I meet that particular particular burden.
You mean under this Section 2 you would meet it?
Yes.
But wouldn't it be met anyway? Couldn't you make a case if somebody possesses a large quantity of anthrax that obviously it's not for research, it could only be used for some nefarious purpose?
You could certainly argue that. You could certainly say you have circumstantial evidence to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Fairlawn.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Senator Ringo's got an excellent point. There's a lot of substances out there that are potentially harmful, and we don't want to send people into a dither over who has lawful access. But there really is a difference between castor beans and sarin. And there really is a difference between a lawful purpose for a hazardous substance and a hazardous substance packaged or clearly intended to be used to intimidate, harass, or harm. And if there's any area in the law where there happily was a deficiency, it's been in this country relative to people with bad intent that take substances that are normally not harmful and potentially turn them into a weapon. Mm-hmm. Or take substances that are only useful to harm and to threaten to use those or purport to use those. And I think that's what the statute would aim at. I would support it. I would, if there are some drafting difficulties or sharpening that can be done, I think that's certainly understandable. But, you know, we have to remember Oregon's the only place in the United States where there was actually a chemical biological attack on citizens, and that was in Wasco County. And it's, you know, given the 20-year time frame, it's almost laughable to think that the Rajneesh tried to poison a community using a chemical biological agent. In this case, it was botulism toxin. But it happened, and people could have died. People were sickened. And then, you know, the crony that describes the bill talks about the letter that was received here in the Capitol building purported to be anthrax. You would have had to talk to some of those mailroom staff the day that they were exposed to that letter to understand how terrified they were. And they, you know, I encountered a couple of the mail staff outside the building sitting on the lawn waiting for the hazmat people to tell them whether they needed to go to the emergency room to be decontaminated or undergo some kind of medical techniques for, you know, against anthrax, or go home. And that's a pretty tough place to put people. There's got to be some deterrent. We just have to have tools to deal with this. Thank you,
Chair Menace. The one thing I would like to respond is I think that's a good example of how terrified those people are, and certainly that conduct should be equally as serious as someone who steals a car. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, stealing a car is serious, but, you know, when somebody thinks they've been poisoned in their life,
you know, maybe ending the next day, that's that type of conduct should be more than a misdemeanor. That's, I think that's the reason why I...
All right. Thank you, John. And I assume you're going to be part of a work group, too, here soon.
I suspect so.
Ingrid Swenson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I think we understand what Senator Burdick was seeking to do in this measure, and our concerns have to do with the way the bill is drafted and the breadth of scope that this bill covers. If you look at the Hope's destructive device statute, of course, that provides penalties for a sort of similar offense, and this could be analogous to that. However, in those circumstances, ordinarily, the hoax destructive device is not something that is used to alarm a large segment of the public, but an individual or something. So you might indeed find that the conduct here would require something other than a Class A misdemeanor or Class C felony treatment. As I look at the bill, I notice a couple of things about it. First of all, Section 1, as described by Mr. Bradley, does indeed create this new offense with the following elements. And I set them out there just because it's a little easier for me to see them that way. First of all, you have to intentionally develop, manufacture, deliver, possess, or use for an unlawful purpose a harmful substance. And those terms are defined in the bill. Unfortunately, this definition covers a lot of conduct beyond what I think this bill was addressed to. And as both Senator Ringo and Senator Ferry only pointed out, it can cover conduct which, while unlawful, doesn't certainly rise to the level of Class A felony treatment. For example, I think of using a weed killer on your lawn. And if you should be annoyed by your neighbor's weeds that grow over the property line and you happen to put some of that weed killer on the other side of the property line, thereby affecting his property, it would be a trespass and technically would come under the terms of this measure. Using a cleaning substance that was unlawful because it wasn't approved by EPA, for example, in cleaning a factory or something like that, that also could be covered as long as it's unlawful and you do it intentionally and it's harmful, a harmful chemical or biological substance. And indeed, all the cases I would think of dumping of chemicals which violate EPA policy would also be covered by Section 1 of this measure. I think there are ways to ameliorate the harsh effects of the statute as drafted, and that would be to do some things like you could add an element, and I think Senator Ringo was suggesting this, that there be a requirement that a person or more than one person be placed in fear of serious physical injury. Because, of course, that's what you're after, is people who are intimidating and terrorizing the public. The two terms, the chemical and biological substance, are defined in terms of the possibility of creating injury. You could narrow the focus of the bill somewhat by requiring that it be serious physical injury that's risked there as well in those definitional terms. Okay. So those are our main concerns about that section. Section 7 of the bill creates this offense of menacing in the first degree. And the sort of existing law provisions which might be applicable to the conduct we're talking about there would be either disorderly conduct, as Mr. Bradley was describing, which is ordinarily directed at false alarms and that sort of thing, or menacing, which is putting a person in fear of serious physical injury. This Section 7, the offense created there, has basically two elements. One, it requires that a person intend to cause the public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, or recklessly create a risk, so you don't even have to intend that outcome. And secondly, the person must initiate or circulate a threat of an alleged or impending catastrophe of some kind. And the way it's drafted, this would penalize a citizen who reported an actual emergency, because it doesn't require that it be a false catastrophe or a made-up situation. Class B felony treatment would seem to be extreme for someone who did such an act recklessly. If you're getting at someone who acts intentionally, that might be appropriate. But if you acted recklessly, Class B felony treatment might be too severe. You could perhaps make knowing conduct subject to the measure and intentional conduct, but not necessarily reckless conduct. This whole new form of menacing creates some kind of unusual combination of elements of the disorderly conduct and the menacing statute. And I don't think that the public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm is really what you're wishing to avoid so much as the effect in most menacing cases, which is placing people in fear of imminent serious physical injury. So I suggested that you might look at changing those elements to require that a person intend to place the public or multiple persons in any case, or at least knowingly place those persons in fear of imminent serious physical injury, and then require that the person initiate or circulate a false threat of catastrophe. Andrea Meyer from the ACLU could not be here this morning, but she asked me to raise the same question which Mr. Bradley himself has already raised, which is the proportionality problem in the bill as it's currently drafted.
Great. Ingrid, thank you very much. Terry Witt. Good morning, Terry.
Hello. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We represent manufacturers, distributors, and users of pesticides, fertilizers, and biotechnology. I'll keep my comments very brief. I would just like to offer my services to work on this bill. I think, as has been testified by several previous persons, we think that the bill unintentionally casts too large of a net, particularly when you look at some of the definitions. I think they can use some tweaking. For example, when you talk about a delivery system being an apparatus intended to deliver a harmful biological substance or chemical substance, any sprayer that's used for pesticides, whether they be biological pesticides or chemical pesticides, is a delivery system intended to deliver a material that's designed to control or kill an animal or a plant. So you have this kind of a situation set up where you're applying a material. The intent is to kill a plant or an animal in the case of an insecticide or pesticide or rodenticide. And how do we draw the fine line between that legal act and the intent of this bill? I think we need to work on that. And I think the other area that is, I understand that when you talk in Section 2, for example, where it's mentioned that it's an intentional act and it's for an unlawful purpose, that in today's environment there is a very, very fine line between lawful and unlawful. And one example for it, I think, is specific here, that any application of a pesticide that is different than what is required by the label is, in effect, an illegal or unlawful activity. So, for example, if a farmer were to have misread the label, or instead of, and some of these chemicals are applied in grams per acre, so if a farmer would have misread the label and instead of applying 10 grams per acre, applied 11 grams per acre, that's an unlawful activity intended for killing another plant. And I think it's a very, very narrow window that could be used for other purposes. And I'd just like to make one last comment. I know people say, well, that's absurd. No one would attempt to use this particular piece of legislation for that purpose. I would like to remind the committee that we have seen third-party lawsuits filed in the courts which force agencies to implement laws in ways that they were not normally intended to be implemented. And it takes the flexibility and the interpretation of implementing that law out of the hands of the agency that has the authority to enforce. With that, like I say, I would be more than happy to work with any person to try to make sure that the net is very narrow and that it achieves the purpose that Senator Burdick is attempting to achieve.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't sense any other questions, Terry. We'll do another work group here. Virginia.
I see a work group coming.
Yes. I assume you want to work on your bill.
Yes.
Okay.
Council
and Mr. Bradley, Ingrid, and Terry will work together. And
Andrea Meyer as well.
And Andrea Meyer? Is she with the ACLU?
She has spoken to me about this.
Uh-huh. Okay. And Andrew, you can include whoever you want, Honorable Vice Chair. So we're going to be done with the public hearing on that. How long do you think it'll take to get that letter together?
Mr. Bradley might have some insight into that.
Why don't we try 2 weeks? We'll bring it back, and okay. I won't expect a completed project necessarily, but at least some progress on structure. And I think everybody's appropriately spoke to the structure issues. I think we do need to make sure that we say what we mean, given
right.
the interpretation.
And it could be we come back with two bills as well.
Yes, that works for me, too. All right, then. Where I lost my stuff here. All right, Senate Bill 23, work session. Okay. Public hearing on Senate Bill 23. And let me see. Sharon Gorham. Am I correct? Gorham? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Gorham. I'm the director of the Victim Services Program of the Lane County District Attorney's Office. I'm here to speak strongly in favor of this bill. And I'm here to tell you that we have a system in place that in Lane County for stalking protective orders, and it works. And I'm passing out to you our packet that we use. I want to tell you, though, that through a collaborative effort with the Domestic Violence Council, Legal Aid, the District Attorney's Office, Victim Services, and the courts, there's a revision being made to this packet which incorporates the language about the federal language about dispossession of firearms. And so that packet has been approved in Lane County. I think Lane County wanted to use up all our old packets before they printed the new ones. Lane County Victim Services Program helps people fill out these packets. We do approximately 200 protective orders a month, of which there's, I believe, between 30 and 40 stalking orders. And while that seems like a huge amount, I would submit to you that it shows that there's a big need for this service. There's a difference, I believe, between a police-issued citation for stalking and a stalking protective order that is done through this process. If the police issue a citation, the hearing must be held in a very short amount of time, which puts a petitioner who is not represented by counsel in an uncomfortable position of needing to understand courtroom procedures and perhaps getting a lawyer, understanding how to subpoena witnesses. That's very difficult for these people to accomplish in a short amount of time. I don't really have anything else to tell the committee except that Lane County, through the district attorney's office, provides this service, and it's working. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer anything that I can.
Okay. Is this your bill?
It is not my bill.
Okay. All right.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I should probably take This is a bill that was worked on, through the interim. David, can I give you credit for this bill, or should I? David Niebel drafted this bill, and it was introduced in 2001 as House Bill 2880. It did not go through, even though there was a unanimous consent that there were some good policy choices in it, albeit disagreements about how it should be put into practice. So it comes from the interim. We worked on this with a large group of people over the interim.
All right. Thanks for the background. Appreciate your testimony. Ingrid, you're up again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciated being involved in many of the meetings of that work group, and many of the comments that we would have had were handled in that work group. However, we maintained the right to object to some of the provisions of this measure, and we do. As I look at Senate Bill 23, our first concern would be on page 2, line 35, where it talks about award of attorney's fees, and it provides that only the petitioner may receive an award of attorney's fees. We clearly think that the respondent ought to be eligible for an award of those fees under appropriate circumstances, as well as the petitioner. I think from the defense standpoint, we have an overriding concern with stalking orders and FAPA orders as well, in that they can be misused. We understand that there is a good purpose for both of these laws and that they serve a much-needed function. However, we also are in a position to see significant abuse of both of these statutes. And in the FAPA area and in the stalking area, sometimes people use these as weapons against each other in a way that doesn't protect either party and that tends to use law enforcement resources in a way that I don't think is necessary and appropriate. And because of that concern, we think that it's appropriate to sort of narrow the scope of some of the provisions of both the stalking and the FAPA order. One change which is presented here, which is a positive one, does require that the application or the petition require that it be under oath or affirmation. I think that'll help, frankly. If the petitioner has to, you know, make these statements under oath, that might limit some of the circumstances where people use them for vindictive purposes. However, in Section 3 of this measure, it continues to require that if the court finds there is probable cause based on the allegations to issue an order, the court must issue that order. So the court is not allowed to look beyond. This is in the initial application for a protective order, before a hearing on the merits. It's an ex parte proceeding. And the court is not allowed to look beyond the four corners of that affidavit or petition to determine probable cause. I think that's a significant concern, and you may have seen House Bill 2177, which is pending in House Judiciary Committee, and that is a bill which was brought by the correctional officers to prohibit inmates from obtaining stalking orders against correctional officers. And the judges who have issued those orders indicate that they felt they had no choice, because the law technically required them not to look beyond the petition itself. As the chair of the House Judiciary Committee indicated, the stalking law is broad enough where probably most lobbyists would be covered by the provisions of the stalking law. So I'm thinking that it would be appropriate to allow the court to issue the order when probable cause is established, but rather than requiring it, to make it discretionary so that the court can consider, is this a situation involving a prison inmate who's asking for protection from the annoying efforts of a correctional officer to control his behavior. I don't see why a police officer wouldn't be subject to a stalking order for repeated contacts with the same individual. That person could see that as threatening to their personal safety. It's unwanted, and the person has said, leave me alone.
But if you write the statute so that the petition itself permits the court, or requires the court to issue it despite the circumstances, I think that's a problem. Another concern we have with stalking orders is that they are for indefinite periods of time. There is no time limit, so technically they're permanent, forever. And some of the circumstances that give rise to stalking, appropriate stalking orders, are time limited. For example, students who attend the same school, and once they graduate, there really isn't a concern about future contact. But nevertheless, these orders are of indefinite duration. Excuse me, I thought I had one further comment, but I think that's most of it.
Do you, Ingrid, have your comments on paper?
I don't, but I could certainly reduce them to writing.
Would you do that?
Sure.
I think you raised some good issues. Good point. All right. Thank you very much. Carrie Rasmussen?
Good morning, Chair and Minister. Carrie Rasmussen, Deputy District Attorney, Marion County. My comments this morning were intended to be very brief and just to tell the committee that the Oregon District Attorneys Association does support this bill. However, I feel I feel the need to respond to a couple comments made by Ms. Swanson. First, regarding this issue of misusing the stalking orders and the restraining orders, As a deputy district attorney, I have seen that misuse, and I've also not charged a contempt of court based on what I perceive in the police reports as misuse. District attorneys do have discretion to file charges that we think are founded and not file those that aren't founded. So I do think that there is some discretion there that avoids some of that potential misuse. And misuse isn't just limited to the stalking order and restraining order context. I've seen misuse of the 911 system. I've seen people call the police for reasons that certainly weren't honorable and were meant simply to get somebody in trouble. And that's part of my job, is to ferret those cases out. Moving on to this issue of whether a person could or would get a restraining order, or actually a stalking order, against a police officer, as proposed by Ms. Swanson. The section in the statute that talks about whether it is objectively reasonable for a person in the victim's situation to have been alarmed or coerced by the contact, and in addition, that contact did actually cause that alarm or coercion, is key. I mean, I think that's where a judge has to look at the situation and hopefully would find that a person being alarmed or afraid by a police officer's contact might not be objectively reasonable. And I think that the judges can ferret out that situation. I don't know what happened with the situation with the guards in the jail. I'm not familiar with that bill, or just how many stalking orders were actually given in that case. And I did not intend to speak to the fiscal impact of the bill this morning, but I was handed a memorandum from Adrian Sexton sent to Craig Prinz, and I don't know if members of the committee would have the memorandum, but page 2 talks about costs for violations of a stalking protective order. Page 2 of the memo. And what's illustrative to me is that the very last line in the second paragraph under that heading of cost for violations of a stalking protective order, it says only 0.5% of all protective order violations result in a Class C felony charge. And I think what that speaks to is that these stalking orders are working, that they are avoiding future felony charges. In my experience in the last 2 years in Linn County, and now I work here in Marion County. In my 2 years in Linn County, I had several stalking cases, a couple of which I know resulted in avoidance of at least felony assault, if not murder. One of the people that I sent, that the court sent to prison for 3 years, had threatened repeatedly to kill the person that he was stalking. And this was not a relationship situation. This was a stranger stalking case. And I do believe that the fact that he's now incarcerated stopped a further crime from happening. So, you know, I think we all know how expensive person misdemeanor crimes and indeed felonies can be on the court system, and I think that these stalking orders do prevent future crimes from happening. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
I don't sense that there are any at this moment. Thank you. David Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Niebel. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women and also on behalf of the low-income clients of the Oregon Law Center in favor of Senate Bill 23. Senate Bill 23 would make the stalking protective order procedure clearer and easier to use, and it would also direct the court system to draft and make available to the public the forms that a person would need to file for protection on his or her own. As has been mentioned, this is an outgrowth of a work group during the interim that worked hard to find common ground on changes to the stalking protective order procedure. It grew out of a bill, as has been mentioned, House Bill 2880, last session. And ultimately, the work group came to a place where what was agreed to was making the procedure easier, providing the forms, but not really making much substantive change, if any, to the stalking law, to the standards that a court would apply in deciding whether or not to issue an order or any other part of the stalking law. Just as background, under current law, a stalking victim can seek an order through one of two means. The first is by asking a police officer to issue a citation to an alleged stalker to show up in court and say why a stalking order should not be entered. That's one way. The other way is by going to court directly and seeking a protective order through court by filing a petition in court under ORS Chapter 30. In some areas of the state, the police officer route works very well. I think in Marion County, for example, most, if not all, stalking protective orders result in police officer citations.
At the risk of being rude, I've known you for many, many years. Some of the members are gone. I'm going to bring you back tomorrow to finish your testimony on this. And there are several other witnesses on this bill who are also local.
Right.
Who I'll bring back tomorrow. There's one issue I want to bring up because there are folks that it would be a little bit more difficult for them to come back tomorrow. So if I can, you beg my...
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's fine.
And I'll bring you back tomorrow. You'll be... Well, I can't bring you back tomorrow. I'll bring you back.
Well, I can too.
Yeah, we'll bring you back tomorrow. Do we have the 24-hour notice?
Yes.
Okay.
I think we can... let's see, what can we do?
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll bring you back Wednesday. Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay? Wednesday? And I apologize, but we're kind of compressed with
no,
the time.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill, whichever one, or 23, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 46. We've got Lori Abraham from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and Matt Ingen from the Portland Police Bureau. unidentified gentleman. Oh, okay.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. I'm Jonathan Fussner from the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals at DOJ. And because Senate Bill 46 became necessary due to a Court of Appeals decision that the state lost, I'm here to give the committee just a brief background on how that happened, what the Court of Appeals ruled, and then turn it over to Lori Abraham from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and Officer Matt Engen from Portland Police Bureau to give you some real-world illustrations of the problems caused by this opinion. This has to do with the criminal trespass statutes, which essentially make it a crime to enter or remain unlawfully in certain premises. What we're talking about here are premises that are open to the public. And the existing statute for many, many years was interpreted by the courts, and the statute I'm referring to is ORS 164.205, subsection 3, was interpreted for many years by the courts to mean that a person entered or remained unlawfully if they either entered premises after having been ordered to stay out of them or remained on the premises after being lawfully ordered to leave. So you got these two different concepts, entering when you don't have a right to enter or refusing to leave after you've been told to leave. In State versus Collins, which was decided in February of 2002 by the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals interpreted that statute a different way. In our view, they misread the statute and did not affect the legislature's intent when that statute was passed. But what the court held was, when we're talking about premises open to the public, it is trespassing only if a person remains after being lawfully ordered to leave, that is, refuses to leave when told to do so. But it's not trespassing to enter the premises after being ordered not to. The result of this is we have this bizarre situation in which a person can be lawfully ordered to leave, and provided that they leave, they can come right back and be ordered to leave again and come right back. And that's essentially the legal problem, without getting into all of the intricacies of how the Court of Appeals analyzed it, which I think are really not too important to the committee's work on this bill. At this point, I'd like Lori Abraham and Officer Engen to tell you how this has played out in the real world.
All right. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, I'm Lori Abraham. I'm a Multnomah County District Attorney and have been for about 20 years now. For the last 8 years, I have worked with members of the community on their public safety issues that they have. They come to me with and the police department as well, and we try to work on strategies on how to deal with their criminal problems. And basically, that's because obviously arrest and prosecution aren't always the solutions to the criminal problem. One of the things that we've worked on a lot is telling property owners that you need to police your properties, and you need to do that by using your power to exclude people who commit crimes on your property. We don't always have enough police officers or prosecutors to always have all those people arrested, and so the exclusion tool has been a powerful tool for property owners to use. The Collins decision gutted the use of that exclusion tool and basically made it a mockery. And so that's why I'm in support of this bill. I'm in support of the fact that you've now added to that section and made it very clear that after you've been denied entry to a premise that's open to the public, like a retail store, you can't then come back without committing the crime of trespass, because that's what the exclusion tool allows property owners to do, to exclude people that are doing bad things on their property, off their property. So let me give you some examples. Of my phone started kind of ringing off the hook, because obviously I had to go tell police officers that we were not going to be able to prosecute their arrest when people were not first told they had to leave. We had at least, I can't tell you the exact number, but over 100 cases we had to go and dismiss because they were cases where people had come back into, say, a retail establishment, a restaurant, a mom-and-pop grocery store, after they'd been told to not come back anymore, and they were arrested for trespass, but they had not been told, of course, to leave and given that opportunity to leave. So we had to dismiss many cases. So obviously I had people calling me, well, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do with this person that comes every day? He comes in here and eats all my food without paying for it and stuff. What am I supposed to do with him? Now, obviously, sometimes those people are committing other crimes, but some of the examples that I have...
Senator Ringo. I would appreciate it if you could just give me a little more context. I mean, who are these people coming back? Are they shoplifting? Are they scamming food from restaurants?
Okay.
Are they begging?
Let me say, shoplifters, most of them are shoplifters, yes. A high percentage of them are shoplifters. They have been told by stores, of course, not to come back because they're no longer wanted there after shoplifting.
And they go back to those same
stores. They go back to those same stores.
It's fertile.
Right. It is. And they usually get away with it, too. I mean, it's not always that they get caught. I mean, sometimes we're prosecuting the same person many, many times going to the same store. But because they often get caught again for trespassing, we can do them for criminal trespass in the first degree. So we were able to still handle the shoplifter. The people we can't handle are, I had a particular store had an employee that they had fired. For reasons I don't know about. But he had threatened to come back and shoot everybody in the store. So the post office type of person, right? You're telling him he's no longer welcomed on the premises, obviously. They were worried because they didn't want to have to confront him when he stepped back into the business. They wanted to call the police officer to come and confront him because they're worried that if they confront him, they're going to get hurt. But I said to them, there is no way that the police can come and do anything about that other than hopefully stand by and help you. Because we can't arrest that person for trespass. He has to be approached and told he has to leave. I had a church, the minister, called because every Sunday they had the same person in the church who would decide to scream at the minister. He had been kind of coming in, and he'd been a fairly good parishioner for a while, and then decided he didn't like the minister any longer and started telling various terrible things during the service, okay? And they wanted to get rid of him. And they're calling and saying, how come the police won't come any longer and arrest this person? And it's because every time they did tell him to leave, he would leave. But then he would come back in a half an hour, or he'd come back the next Sunday.
That helps.
Right. So that's the contents of what it is. One of the other areas is basically, you know, we've had lots of problems with people in malls who are engaging in fighting activity. A good example is rival gang members. And so they will be excluded because they've engaged in physical fights in the mall. And the mall security want to be able to tell those people they can't come back and have a tool. What happens with these kind of people is they're not dumb. They have figured out in Portland that they can come back to all these areas, and as long as they leave each time that they're told, they're not going to get arrested. But that doesn't solve our crisis that we're in right now. And so I would recommend, you know, that this be at least given an emergency clause as well, because for the last year we have been in this really problem period where we have not been able to deal with the problems that we have. So this change, this adding of new subsection C, makes it possible for all lawful orders not to reenter to be then enforced, and that would be my goal here today.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Chairman. Before the Collins decision, when you thought you still had the authority to exclude someone once they had been asked to leave the first time, what kind of time period? For example, if someone was asked not to come to the mall, mm-hmm. are we talking 30 days, 10 years?
Every private property owner or public property owner has the right to kind of make a determination about how long they're going to exclude people for. And I've worked over the years with, like, the libraries, with small businesses, and talked to them about the fact that you need to decide, for this kind of behavior, how long do you think that person should be excluded? If it's behavior that's minor to them, they exclude them for 30 days. If it's behavior that is serious to them, they could exclude them permanently if they wanted to. There's a varying degree of
but
how
the idea,
long.
The idea was that the property owner set that limit and informed
yes.
them, and then they were expected to comply?
Correct. In fact, many times it's in writing. With small businesses, it's usually verbal, but with larger businesses, it's in writing given to them. For this many days, starting now, you are not allowed to come back onto these premises.
Well, if it's necessary to set it out, if it's no longer assumed, if it's necessary to set it out in statute, do you think it's necessary to put language in there saying how the length is determined? is determined by the property owner, or is it a set period? This is open-ended and indefinite. This looks like a lifetime ban.
Right. No, I don't think it's important to put that in, because I think it's important that each property owner make that decision themselves, and I don't think we can do that for them, actually.
The issue is that if you did arrest somebody based on that desire of the property owner to not allow someone there, their testimony would be required in court.
That's correct.
The charge, which means that they said what they meant originally and they still mean it, and therefore, which is to say that what the court did is basically say that that intent of the landowner ends as soon as the person complies initially, and it doesn't continue in perpetuity as long as the landowner or property owner, or whoever has control of the property, continues to desire to restrict that person's access to the premise.
You know, obviously, you could be sued if you excluded somebody off your property for, you know, for reasons that were based on their race, their sex, I suppose they could sue you if they thought that you were excluding them for too long a period of time or things like that. But those are all issues that, you know, are really not relevant to the criminal trial. The criminal trial is you were told not to come on, you knew you were told, you came back anyway.
Right.
And if they chose to then try to contest why they were excluded, that would have to be in a different forum.
But if you were in a situation where, say, the library excluded someone for 30 days,
mm-hmm.
and on, you know, day 29 they come back in and they get arrested because the library said 30 days, and then they go to court and the person said, no, they only excluded me for 15 days.
And he could say that. Yeah, he could say that, and it would be an evidentiary issue that we'd have to deal with in court. So he certainly has the right to bring that up, and some people, you know, obviously are able to convince the judge or the jury that they weren't told 30 days, they were told 14, and they are found not guilty.
But do you think it might make sense, to, since it has been a dispute, to specify that it's in writing or in some way that can be documented?
No, I would not recommend that, because I think any property owner has the right to tell you that, and they shouldn't have to do so in writing. I think they have the right to do that verbally. I would feel that way, particularly small businesses. You know, they're not set up with a procedure, say, such as Meyer and Frank's or Fred Meyer's is. And so I think it wouldn't be fair to them to require a more written procedure, a more formal procedure, because, frankly, again, it's an evidentiary issue. If the person says that I was not told or they didn't make it clear to me, then they'll be found not guilty, obviously. But it's the burden of proof there.
Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't have any problem understanding the circumstances under which you want, as a business owner, even operating a business open to the public, would want to be able to exclude people who are disruptive or potentially threatening or harmful. Please explain to me how that scenario plays itself out in a truly public space. For instance, we've been hearing, we heard in last legislative session about bans on folks going into Pioneer Square.
Ban on thugs? Is that what you said?
Folks.
Folks. Sorry.
Some folks are not thugs.
Okay. No, I thought you said thugs. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, a public place, one not a proprietary ownership,
right,
open to the public, but truly public space.
I obviously, this law applies to private property owners as well as public property owners, and obviously the city of Portland owns Pioneer Square, and it's a park in Pioneer Square, and so cities across the country have taken steps toward having rules of behavior in their parks, and people who violate those rules of behavior in their parks, particularly committing any kind of criminal activity in them, can be excluded from those parks. And they do that via city council, obviously does that via an ordinance. They have testimony on it. They actually have in writing how long they can exclude people for, what reasons they can exclude people for. So obviously public property owners tend to take a more formal approach to actually using this exclusion tool than private property owners. So that's how they do it. I mean, people are, yes, excluded from Pioneer Square if they commit criminal activity or violate other park rules that are promulgated by city council.
Officer Egan.
Ingen.
Thank you. Tell us what you do.
Thank you, Chairman and Senators. My name is Matthew Ingen. I'm a police officer of the city of Portland, and I'm a senior neighborhood officer representing Northwest Portland. I believe
my colleagues here have enumerated to you the difficulties we face trying to enforce a trespass code as it currently stands under the Collins ruling. And specifically as police officers, it's very frustrating for us to respond to businesses and other locations dealing with typically chronic trespassers, unwanted and transient folks, and we're caught between the current ORS and the landlord who wishes us to take police actions. Historically, we would be able to do so and either remove or arrest a person who has a prior been trespassed from the area. As it stands now, all we can do is ask them to leave, and as long as they do so in any manner they do so, no crime has been committed. And in general, that seems like it's not a big deal. However, specifically, we have people that come back time after time after time and take advantage of this loophole. Specifically, I received a phone call from a downtown business just this week in which they expressed that between 3 and 4 times a night, a particular individual who is a drug addict and roams around the downtown area comes into the open lobby of their business and both harasses the security guards as well as patrons coming and going from the late night restaurant that's located on the upper floors. And each time they ask him, please leave, and he meets them with a stream of vulgarities and slowly does so after wandering around the lobby, only to return 15, 30, or 40 minutes later and repeats this over and over again. And I had to explain them quite painfully for me from a police officer's point of view, there's really nothing I can do because as long as he leaves, albeit slowly, when you ask him to, he's committed no crime, and he repeatedly comes back and does this every day. The change that we're asking for does not give us any new sweeping powers, does not rewrite the code at any significant point. It just puts us back to where we were historically 1 year ago. I know time is brief. I will entertain any questions.
Let me just ask you quickly, what advice do you give to business owners who want to exclude someone for their premise? Do you ever ask them to write notes or keep notes?
Locations that have chronic problems with trespassers typically will have forms, will have photographs, they'll take Polaroids of people that chronically come in. They will give the person written notice that will spell out the address, the physical location of the premise they're trespassed from, as well as the time length. Those are for your Fred Meyers, your larger locations, your Good Samaritan hospitals. Your small one-person mom-and-pop grocery at 23rd and Gleason, they're going to say, hey, Bob, get out of here. Don't come back. And when you tell somebody, don't come back, you're right. That's a lifetime ban, and that's pretty clear to someone. Now, if they were to come back a year or two later, No, it's never been an issue that I didn't know I wasn't excluded or this or that. That's never been a problem.
Senator,
yes, ma'am.
How does this apply to drug-free zones?
Senator Muniz, or Chairman and Senator Burdick, the city of Portland has written its own language and created its own violation that is of violating a city ordinance. And so we're not looking to specifically enforce the trespass language or as this new bill in regards to drug-free zones. We have shifted our focus from using trespass, the actual crime of trespass. We now charge a different city code, so it's been addressed in that regards.
If I can address that more thoroughly, obviously the case of Lawrence Collins versus the state of Oregon versus Lawrence Collins did arise out of a public property trespass exclusion that a person then violated. And so as I explained with the parks, it is a similar type of situation. The city of Portland has decided that it has the authority to control its streets and sidewalks. And it has decided that in areas of the city that are particularly hard hit with drug activity, illegal drug activity, where people are being arrested and prosecuted for drug activity in that area, if it is particularly heavy, that is, it's definitely, you can look at it on a map and see there's all these dots where people have actually been arrested compared to other parts of the city. So it's just, that is a hard-hit area. They've decided that they have the right to tell those people, if you get arrested on that sidewalk
for dealing drugs, you can't come back there for 90 days because we don't think you should be allowed to come back to that neighborhood and stand on that sidewalk again, you know, regardless of what you're doing. You should not be allowed to do that unless you're coming there for a lawful purpose. So they made an ordinance to do that. And so, therefore, they took the same theory that they had with the parks and said, if you come back to that area, you're committing trespass. And that trespass law is what, again, enforced the city's exclusion power, just like it did Meyer and Frank's exclusion power, Safeways, or the mom-and-pop grocery store. But what has happened, of course, is the city was able to then say, State of Oregon versus Collins, cut out our ability to enforce our drug-free zone ordinance. So they actually did pass their own ordinance and said it was a violation of the drug-free zone exclusion that they've given you to come back into that area, and that's what Officer Ingen was talking about. It's certainly, you know, I certainly think the city would be interested in going back to using trespass, but they have created their own law as well to cover this period now where we had no teeth in the exclusion.
Okay, let me be clear
process.
Then. Without this statute, or after the Collins case, you can still enforce your drug-free zone under this other authority?
In October, we were able to get, the city was able to then make a new law that allowed us now to start enforcing that ordinance again. And the park exclusions, they already had an ordinance on the books that said people can't violate the lawful directions of park officers, and we were able to use that from the very beginning after the Collins decision. The people that were particularly hard hit was private property owners. The public entities were able to look at other laws that they could apply to enforce their exclusions. Private property owners, of course, were not able to, and they were the ones that are really in the crisis here more than the cities.
That's very interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. Salzger, want to come up with a minute? And I'll get to OCDL, and I appreciate the committee sticking around, probably pushing the threshold with our staff, I'm sure. Mr. Salzger.
Chairman, as members of the committee, thank you. I'll be very brief. We're submitting written comments for the record. I am Mike Salzgiver. I serve as State Government Affairs Manager for the Portland Business Alliance. We're here to give our strong support and endorsement of Senate Bill 46. We are hearing from a number of members who own businesses in the Portland metropolitan area that they are unable to provide order maintenance and property protection in a number of cases when they are because of the effect of this ruling. The previous panel, I think, outlined the technical issues that and legal issues that are the cause of it. And we simply would ask your strong and quick support for this bill.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Any questions for Mr. Salzger?
Thank you.
Thank you. Susan Russell, OCDLA.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to present a testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 46. Senate Bill 46 expands the definition of enter or remain unlawfully to include entering premises that are open to the public after being lawfully denied entry. By doing so, Senate Bill 46 greatly enlarges the scope of the criminal trespass and burglary statutes. Under Senate Bill 46, every time a person enters into a part of town or a store from which they have been previously excluded, this will become the crime of criminal trespass. If the person entered the store intending to shoplift, this will become the crime of burglary in the second degree, a Class C felony. If the person attempting to shoplift, who's been previously excluded from the store, fights with the store clerk in order to get away and not be arrested, this will become burglary in the first degree, a Class A felony. Under current law, a defendant must be directed to leave a place open to the public and fail to do so before their behavior becomes the crime of criminal trespass or burglary under those circumstances. Sometimes a defendant may be unaware that they have been excluded from the premises, or may think that the exclusion notice has already expired. This may happen when there is both a court order exclusion and a private exclusion from a store. The time frames
may be different between the court exclusion and the store exclusion. Often the store exclusion is longer than the court exclusion. Court exclusions usually last only during the term of probation, which the person's previously been convicted, say for shoplifting or for criminal trespass. In our opinion, Senate Bill 46 is a very costly measure. It will criminalize a great deal of new behavior. Every time an excluded person enters into a building that is open to the public with the intent to commit a crime, this will constitute burglary in the second degree. Any time they enter onto real property open to the public from which they have been previously excluded, it will constitute the crime of criminal trespass.
One correction, second paragraph, last sentence. If a person fought with a store clerk in order to get away, you say it will become burglary. It seems to me that would be more robbery.
I think it actually does qualify under the burglary in the first degree statute. I can show that to the court.
Okay. All right. Sounds more like robbery to me, but I'm just... Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I'm just wondering how you evaluate the other testimony that was given with the problem of all the premises owner can do is tell the person to leave, and that person would repeatedly come back, and they call the police officer, and the police officer escorts them through the door. How do you solve that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think it's convenient that we've also had one of the stalking bills here that's had some partial testimony. Listening to that testimony, I think what it occurred to me when we were talking about shopkeepers having this repeated unwanted conduct that was causing them alarm and apprehension for their personal safety, those are the specific standards that now apply in our stalking order. So I think that there are other vehicles in which that type of repetitive contact can be addressed. It may also be when we're talking about individuals who are on probation for prior trespasses or for prior problems at the place of business, it may be a term of their condition of probation, so they may be facing other criminal consequences by being in violation of their probation.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Monson.
Thank you, Chairman, Senators. My testimony will be brief. My name is Christy Munson, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I had not planned to testify today, but I just wanted to offer the League's assistance. We filed as amicus in the Collins case, trying to get a clarification of the current rule regarding reentry under the trespass statutes. We have some language that differs a little bit from the bill that you have before you that I think may be able to... if not completely satisfy, at least partially satisfy some of the bill's opponents, and I'd be happy to share that language with anybody who's interested. Just briefly, the only point that I can mention that you haven't heard already, City of Portland, of course, passed its own ordinance to be able to enforce some of their authority regarding trespass in the statute. Many cities have not. Our concern generally is keeping public parks safe and public spaces safe, and to be able to use our authority to exclude people who have caused trouble in those areas. And cities have not passed ordinances such as Portland.
But the League supports Senate Bill 46, yes or no?
We support the concept behind Senate Bill 46. We think we have some language that may be able to tighten it up. And we would be happy to share that with the proponents.
What if I didn't want to hear it?
We'd be happy to share it with you and talk to you, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Are there any questions?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you.
All right, committee, where do you want to go with this? You want to hear the language? Ms. Monson, come back. What's the language? She just jackaled me.
Thank you, Senator.
It's not a good thing.
Never. Very briefly, the language that I have is from the City of Beaverton, who filed the amicus, and it adds in subsection 3 of the statute. Get my bearings here, excuse me.
In section 1.
They define to enter or remain unlawfully. So they add a three. Excuse me. They redefine to enter or remain unlawfully, and they define it as to enter or remain in or upon premises when the premises at the time of such entry or remaining are not open to the public. Strike the or. Add the language to enter or remain in or upon the premises when the entrant is not otherwise licensed or privileged to do so. I think that may assist some of the opponents of the bill in that I heard testimony that was valid, that if somebody was allowed to come back and had served their sentence or served their exclusionary period, that they may be charged with a heightened crime. And I think that adding the otherwise licensed or privileged to do so. And I'd be happy to discuss this with them. And I think that the proper people to discuss it would be City of Beaverton attorneys.
Did you happen to discuss this with the proponents of the bill before?
I was looking for a testimony list. There was no testimony list of who was...
But you knew the Collins decision.
Oh, yes.
It was in the mix here, didn't you?
Yes. And the proponents of the bill and I discussed possible amendments, and we thought perhaps wouldn't be needed. We wanted to talk to each other and see how it went in the committee.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
I'd just like to offer my office the amendments need to be drafted if we wanted to consider those before doing this bill.
Well, I'm going to tell all of the proponents to go get your act together, figure out what you want. I'm a little surprised the League of Oregon City's been a little bit completely different. Additional, well, what I would consider the last one, I was under the impression this bill was ready to go.
I'm sorry.
I'm not really very happy that you haven't communicated with the City of Portland and other proponents of the bill to get the language wired together. Attorney General's office.
We apologize.
So, there we go. We're going to close public.